Welcome to the Product Podcast, brought to you by Product School, the podcast where you get fresh insight from leaders at top tech companies and startups. Remember, you can learn product management in person at our 15 campuses worldwide or study with us online. Visit productschool.com to learn more about our courses. You can also hang out with the leaders from these podcasts at our hundreds of annual events and catch us at ProductCon, the world's largest PM conference that takes place every year across the United States and in London.
Chapter 8, Bringing Your Product to Market. At this point, you've found an opportunity, validated it, gotten your team on board, and built a product. You've done a lot. In fact, if you come from an engineering or design background, you might feel like the hard work's over and you can take a vacation. But for a product manager, there's still more work to do to get your product into the market successfully. As the team at Pragmatic Marketing, a product marketing-focused agency, puts it, launch isn't the end of development, but rather the beginning of selling. As much as we'd like to believe that if we built the perfect product, it will sell itself, the harsh truth is that it won't. If none of your target customers know about, find, or buy your product, it will flop. If the wrong people buy your product, they won't be happy, and your product will flop. Unless you have a solid plan to bring your product to market, it will, most likely, flop. Fortunately, marketing and sales teams exist to make sure the right customers learn about, find, and buy your product. To ensure a successful launch, you'll work closely with the marketing team. Some companies even have a second role within marketing related to product management, the Product Marketing Manager, PMM. Put simply, the PMM is focused externally and is an expert on the customer and the buyer if it's not the same person, such as in enterprise software, whereas the PM will focus internally on getting the product built. Companies that have a PM and a PMM call the PM inbound and a PMM outbound to reflect this differing focus. Workflow-wise, the PMM will often handle customer development and outreach. The PM will take that feedback and research and get the right product built, and the PMM will step back in for launch. During launch, a PMM is responsible for figuring out how to explain the product to the customers, crafting the right go-to-market GTM plan to bring the product to market successfully, and helping the sales team. We'll go through this chapter as if the PM and the PMM are the same person to give you the best understanding of how product and marketing come together during launch. By representing the customer, the marketing and sales team will often ask for the PM's input when forming strategies. For example, if your product is aimed at teens, the PM will know that teens currently use Snapchat and Instagram more than Facebook. The marketing team will use that input as a starting point to determine where to buy display ads. While you won't be responsible for the details of buying display ads, your input will affect where those ads are and what they say. Throughout this chapter, we'll look at launch preparation, at the launch itself, and a bit at post-launch activities. Launch preparation starts way before the product launches with understanding your customers and product messaging. Even though we're covering this material after the product's been built, you will implement this advice while you're building the product. Whether you're releasing a new version of an existing product with minor fixes or releasing a completely new big product, the advice in this chapter will help you. You'll just adjust the scale appropriately. A bug fix release doesn't need a press tour, for example. Understanding customers. To market your product successfully, you'll need to know how your customers make decisions. Thinking about marketing early on, even when you're doing your initial customer development, will help your product enter the market successfully. For example, your customers might expect to buy your product at Best Buy. It can take months for your sales team to set up the relationship so that your product is available in store, which means you can't wait until launch to start the process. Back in Chapter 3, we introduced the Business Model Canvas and the Value Proposition Canvas. At the time, we used them to help look for a product opportunity. We can use the same tools to understand how to best market our product to the right customers by looking at different parts of the canvas. These are the key areas to focus on from a marketing point of view. Customer segments. Who are the key personas? Value proposition. What's the benefit or value each persona will gain from your product? Channels. How does the company reach each persona? Customer relationships. What communication level and type does each persona expect? Revenue streams. How much and how often will the customer pay? As you do your customer research, you'll want to fill out these blocks and expand your persona to include the marketing side. Here are some specific things to make sure your personas address. How the persona would consider your product a success. How the persona perceives your product or company, if you have an existing product. What buying criteria the persona has. How the persona evaluates products, e.g., does he expect a free trial? How the persona perceives your competition. What influence this persona has on the buying process. By fleshing out the marketing side of a persona, you'll help the marketing team make successful decisions. For example, your persona might focus on new parents who look for advice online. Then, the marketing team will do additional research to determine what parenting websites and blogs the actual customers read, along with where they buy diapers and other supplies. In other words, once you know what your personas are, you and the team can figure out what channels the customers they represent use to learn about and purchase new products. That lets your team make choices, like where to buy advertising, so that the right people find your product. The customer relationship block will help your team determine how to reach these customers, too. With an enterprise product and a high-value customer that purchases a lot of licenses, the customer likely expects her account manager to talk to her personally and maybe even come to her office to give a demo. Again, make sure the choices you make for customer relationships match your customer's expectations. Sometimes, especially if you're releasing a completely new version of a product, you'll want to call out any customer segments the product isn't ready for yet. For example, when Apple released Final Cut Pro X, which was a completely rewritten version of Final Cut, it left out certain advanced features and waited for customer feedback to determine which to add back in. This also meant that Apple explicitly didn't market the product to customers they knew needed those advanced features, as those customers wouldn't have been satisfied with this new version. Product messaging. One of the most important things the Business Model Canvas and the Value Proposition Canvas can help you and your team determine is the right product message. Specifically, how do you communicate your product's value to customers and explain why they should care and what problems your product solves? These canvases can help because they specifically ask you to think about your customers' needs, problems, and goals, along with what problems your product solves and what benefits it provides to your target customers. Framing your product in this way, why should the customer care, helps with everything from how you'll sell the product to what features really matter. It's so important that back in Chapter 5, we recommended including at least a first pass at your product's core message in the PRD. If you don't think about the customers you're trying to reach and why they should care, then it will be much harder to find customers. For example, if you're working on a new version of a student loan product, your focus will be on getting students and recent graduates to care about and buy your product. Before you start creating your product's message, make sure you really understand the customer personas you're targeting and how your product fits their life. The Value Proposition Canvas, especially, will help you see those connections. In an ideal world, we'd come up with one universal message that addresses all of your personas, but will likely need different messages for each persona. Using the same message for every persona is like starting every letter you send with "Dear Sir," even if the recipient is a woman. And the same way that you wouldn't greet someone in person with "Dear Sir," you'll likely have different messages for different mediums, from website to email to video ad. In other words, it won't just be the message language that changes. Different personas will want different value propositions and care about different features or use cases. A stay-at-home dad will likely care more about a car's safety rating than its horsepower, whereas a dad having a midlife crisis will care more about horsepower. PMs are frequently responsible for the first pass at a product's messages and will have input into the various forms these messages take. Let's dive into how to craft a great message. We're going to create a message by putting some notes together around the elements that go into a message and then putting those notes together into a message. Key elements of your product's message. We'll start our notes by thinking about the product's themes, which we talked about in Chapter 2. There are three key questions our theme should answer. Why is this product or company important? Why are you doing this? What's special about your company's mission that will make a customer want your product over a competitor's? Ideally, there will be one fundamental theme that answers those three questions. Grab a blank sheet of paper and start writing down what you think your company's core theme is. Revise what you write as needed to make sure that theme applies to all three questions. Let's write down Mover's theme. Mover's founders created the company because they found planning a move to be overwhelmingly stressful, especially while working full-time. Their core theme is making moving as stress-free as possible so that it's easy for you to get to where you want to live. While we might never explicitly say those words to customers, that theme will guide our product messaging. Another element to look at is what's fresh and new about the product. What are we building a message for? On your sheet of paper, create a new section where you list what's fresh and new. In Mover's case, it's the chat feature. Note that the fresh and new part might differ for new versus existing customers. With Mover, we can specifically tell existing customers about the messaging feature. But when we try to reach new customers, we likely have to educate them about Mover in general first, and the chat feature will be a bullet point beneath the main message. This is a common problem companies face, and it's just another reason you'll need different messages for different customers. Rather than telling people about these fresh and new features, though, we want to talk about the benefits they provide to the customer, using the underlying theme and the customer's problems or needs to affect our diction. Next to each new feature you listed, write why the customer should care and how this feature relates to the theme. Mover's chat feature lets customers communicate with moving companies at the customer's convenience, not only from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We could rephrase this to explain why a customer should care by writing, "Never stress about missing a phone call from the movers. Talk with them on your schedule." Continuing with crafting your message, how is your product different and better than what the customer's doing now? This is especially relevant in the messaging for new customers. In another section on your paper, create now and future columns and write out what the customer's doing now and why your product, especially with this new feature, is better. Right now, Mover's customers, both existing and potential, have to stress about answering phone calls and not missing emails from moving companies, even when they're really busy dealing with life. We could further refine our message by saying, "We're taking the hassle out of talking to movers." This is great because it quickly encompasses all types of communication. Talking can mean via phone or email. And we're saying why Mover is better. It's hassle-free. This version of our message is also strong because it's positive. The previous message started with the negative "never," and it's in the customer's diction, talking rather than communicating, and hassle rather than stress. Another aspect of your message is to address what someone's first impression of your product might be, and whether you need to influence that impression. Our first impressions have a big effect on our attitudes. For example, the first time you see 3D software like Unity, it will look overwhelming and complex. Unity addresses this on its website by specifically stating, "You can create any 2D or 3D game with Unity. You can make it with ease." As another example, Clever Pet is a game console for dogs, and at first glance, it looks like it's just the memory game Simon, even though it costs $299. Clever Pet's website explicitly calls out that it's one hub, unlimited games. This wording influences your first impression to know that it's more than just Simon, and it helps justify the $299 price. In your notes for your product, write down what you feel each persona's first impression of your product will be. If you need to influence that impression, write down how you want to shift the perception. Finding your company's voice. After you've assembled your notes, you'll want to think about your voice. This refers to the diction and tone you will use in your marketing and advertising materials, possibly also even inside the product, such as in alert messages. Basically, do you want to have a very formal tone with your customers? A casual tone? A hip tone? Or something in between? Enterprise products traditionally have taken a formal tone to create a business feeling, and consumer products have adopted a casual tone to create a friendly and accessible feeling. The overriding trend now for both enterprise and customer products is to have a more casual and authentic tone. However, some B2B products in highly regulated fields like medicine and finance still have to use very formal and specific voices because the wrong language can get you into legal trouble. Some companies will create formal style guidelines for their brand's voice and require everything from alert panels in the product to every ad to conform to those guidelines. This can make it hard to adapt your message for different customers. Instead, we recommend having a general sense of the voice you want your brand to have, but use that as a starting point and not a required approach. Just make sure you stay consistent within each medium or message. It's confusing if you start a letter with, "Dear Sir," and then switch to, "Hey Dude," in the next paragraph. Using similar diction to your customers can help your customers quickly understand your value proposition. With consumer products, this means not using industry jargon. You'll likely need to cross out and rewrite some of your "why should the customer care" descriptions. For example, Microsoft describes its Surface devices as the most productive devices on the planet and goes on to describe the Surface Book as the ultimate laptop. Right away, you know if you're looking for a high-end laptop, this is the product you want to look at. If you want something to just browse the web, you also know this isn't the right product. If Microsoft had instead listed each device's CPU specs, most customers wouldn't know which product to look at. With enterprise software or specific targeted products, you often want to use certain buzzwords that a customer is looking for. For example, if a head of IT at a hospital is looking to buy a medical record system, he likely cares about compliance with government regulations. Calling out a specific compliance level as part of the message helps him quickly know this product exactly meets his needs. A simple way to make sure you're using the right diction is to ask how a customer would tell a friend about your product. If their diction is similar to yours, excellent. If it's very different, reconsider your word choice. You want your message to match how your customers see the world. Your message gets bonus points if it really creates images and evokes emotions in a customer's mind. Putting the message pieces together. If you were following along, you now have a few pages of notes and ideas for how you could tell a customer about your product. That's excellent because, again, there's no one message that works for all personas on all mediums. For example, what you write in a press release will be different from what's on the product's webpage, and that will be different from how you advertise the product on TV. As another example, how many websites have you gone to that essentially ask you to pick your persona by choosing between texts like For Developers or For Designers. The messaging will be different on each page, focusing on the things each of those personas cares about. While you won't be responsible for creating ads, it's worth looking at ads to understand how other companies express their messages. Spend some time looking at websites and watching ads for products you use or know about. What is the company saying about each product? Is the message explicit or implicit? What diction or imagery does the company use? Video advertising is really interesting to analyze because the message is often implicit, and you'll have to think about what the company was trying to say. Then, note how it chose to convey it. What personas did it appeal to? How did it make those personas clear? What emotions did the ad create? Watch Apple's classic 1984 ad or Google's Parisian Love ad to see two fantastic examples. 1984 focuses on how Macintosh enables you to stand out and break free of your constraints. Parisian Love examines how search changes your life by giving you the answers you need. It's also worth explicitly noting that these ads don't focus on the product. They focus on your life, the experience you want, and how the product helps you have that experience. In general, it's good to figure out the shortest possible message that appeals to the most personas. You'll likely use that message a lot, whether as a soundbite during a meeting, with the press, or as the headline on the product's page. Then, create different, more specific, and more targeted messages as needed, using your notes to guide you. We highly recommend taking a stab at determining this short message early in the product development lifecycle, and then revising it as needed. This will help keep any product decisions focused. Do they enhance or detract from the message? And provide a starting point for discussions about how to bring the product to market. Just like writing user scenarios for stakeholders is the secret to good PRDs, writing your message as a story can help it become clear and resonate more with customers. You can even use it to give increased value to something new that might not seem exciting. For example, if your new feature is a tutorial section on the website, tell a story about how the customer can use these simple tutorials to become an expert on the product very quickly, leaving their peers in the dust. Finally, remember that your message is not about what the product does. It's about what the product lets the customer do. Customers buy your product to make their lives better. Make sure your message clearly highlights how your product will help your customers improve their lives. Chapter 8 Tip. This tip comes from an amazing product leader, Kirk Paulson, SVP for Marketing at DxO. For more than a decade, Kirk directed worldwide product marketing for all photo software and cloud-based services from Apple's headquarters in Cupertino. As an executive for startups Sonic and then Spruce, he helped launch the world's first commercially available DVD encoding and authoring systems. Kirk was also one of the first technology experts to introduce the very concept of computer-based audio and video editing systems to the music and film industries. Ask the DRI to whiteboard it for you. In my experience at a certain fruit-named company, each of our software application releases typically involved dozens of new features and enhancements. For each launch, it was the PM's job to cull the complete list down to half a dozen or so top-level features, TLF, which represented the story of that particular release. It was the responsibility of the PM to present the TLF to the broader marketing team, which included creative directors, copywriters, graphic designers, etc. It was absolutely essential that the message be clear, concise, and delivered with enthusiasm. With clarity and passion, and the entire creative team would get engaged to do their very best work to help you showcase the product. Were the message to lack cohesion or come off as uninspired, the creative team could just as easily disengage, performing mediocre work at best, which would invariably result in the industry giving it a collective yawn. The quickest way for a PM to lose the respect of engineering is to make the product sound boring or obscure. Conversely, one of the best ways for a PM to earn kudos from other teams is to tell the story in an articulate, engaging, and insightful manner. So, how exactly do you figure out how to succinctly and effectively communicate the solution that will make the customer awesome? Simple. For each and every TLF, ask the engineer or scientist most directly responsible for that particular bit to explain it to you in detail in layman's terms. This process requires you to search out the directly responsible individual, DRI, for that exact feature or technology. In some cases, particularly with small startups, it may be the founder. Often, it's the product's chief architect who directs the engineering team. In a Fortune 100 company, it might well be a shy but brilliant scientist who works within one tiny team among a vast R&D organization. What I can assure you is, it isn't someone who is somewhat close to the feature but not directly involved. Rather, it must be the DRI, the person who coded, engineered, designed, or directed the work that led to that particular feature. At Sonic Solutions, it was Dr. Andy Maurer. At Apple, it was usually Randy Ubelos. And at DxO, it is often Dr. Frederick Guichard. When you take the time to identify the precise DRI for that specific feature or technology, you'll discover that that person, and only that person, is capable of explaining it to you in depth and with more clarity than you could possibly imagine. Most important, you have the opportunity to feel firsthand their personal passion for the product and gain a better understanding of the true benefit of the solution as they originally conceived of it. In my experience, this process typically involved either a private, one-on-one session or a very select gathering, but never a large group. And in my experience, it always, always involved a whiteboard, because I've never met an engineer or scientist who wasn't keen to express themselves with an erasable marker. After listening carefully to their description of the feature or technology, it's essential for you to try to immediately channel their voice and repeat what you've just learned, as in, "So, would I be correct in describing this as?" The process, which involves focused listening and detailed note-taking, may well require several interactions before you are in complete harmony with the DRI and are able to perfectly articulate, in layman's terms, the solution. Follow this tip, and you, as the PM, will be properly equipped to tell a great story to the creative marketing team, who will help you share your message with the industry, media, channel partners, and your soon-to-be-awesome customers. Going to market. It's tempting to think that once development's done and you've put together an initial product message in the PRD, you can just give the product to marketing or sales and let them do their thing. But what happens if, during launch, your server crashes and your engineering team is out of the office celebrating? Or worse, what if the marketing team didn't fully understand the product's new features, targeted the wrong PR or advertising outlets, and no one showed up for the launch? Many companies create launch checklists, preset templates of the information the marketing team needs to launch a product. But the problem is that not every product launch is the same, either in terms of the product you're launching or how people receive information. For example, a big product launch might warrant an event that you live stream. 5 years ago, live streaming wasn't an easy option. In a couple of years, live streaming in virtual reality or some other way we can't imagine now might be the norm. And if you're launching a new version of a small feature, you likely don't need a live stream at all. A great way to launch a product is to identify a launch owner early on, to form a team with representatives from each key group, design, engineering, product, support, and marketing, and to establish clear launch objectives and responsibilities within a go-to-market GTM plan. Sometimes the launch owner is the PM, but PMs are often busy enough that someone else from the marketing team will take on this role. Although the launch owner will organize and manage the GTM plan, each department will contribute to it. Each week, the team will meet to make sure everything is on track to ensure a successful launch, and they'll communicate any delays or issues and discuss solutions. For these meetings, it's helpful to create a launch tracker to organize the launch. 3 sheets in a spreadsheet are sufficient. The first sheet will contain the action items. These are specific tasks assigned to a particular person or team, along with when each task was assigned, when it was due, and any comments or status updates appropriate for the task. The second sheet will contain caution items. These are possible problem issues, along with who raised them, when they raised them, when each issue was resolved, and any comments. The last sheet will have key decisions, including who made them, when, and any comments. In the same way the PRD is a living document that acts as the key product resource as you build the product, this launch tracker will be your launch reference. A lot of the work you've done so far, from identifying your target customers, to analyzing the competition, to developing product messages for each persona, will inform your overall strategy and influence the decisions you make within the GTM planned. Keep those in mind as you read this section. At a high level, the GTM plan is subdivided into 3 sections: pre-launch, launch, and post-launch. Let's look at each. Pre-launch planning. The main things to decide during pre-launch are the key launch goals, how you'll make sure the product is ready for that launch, when and how you'll launch the product, and what assets you need to launch. Launch objectives. Launches have different purposes. For some products, like the latest Google Pixel smartphone, the goal is likely to get as many customers as possible upgrading to this phone or new customers buying the phone. For enterprise software like Salesforce, the goal might be getting a subset of customers engaged with a new feature. Sometimes the goal is simply awareness of a new feature, so that when customers enter their buying cycle, your product is on their mind. Identifying your key goals up front will let you make other launch decisions, such as when to aim to launch your product. Launch timing. After the launch objective, most launch teams identify when they want to launch the product. Sometimes this is a specific date, but usually it's a date range. For example, consumer product launches tend to happen at the start of the year, in late April, early May, for the dads and grads windows, Father's Day and graduation, or after the summer but before Black Friday. It's important to pick this launch window as early as possible because it can affect your product's development. If you're selling a consumer product and the development team thinks it will be ready to launch December 26th, then you'll have missed the entire window from Black Friday to Christmas when consumer products sell well. If you want to have the product available for holiday shopping, you'll need to reduce your product's scope to have it ready in time. Businesses sometimes have buying periods too that you might need to time your launch around. Schools often purchase products in the spring and summer, before the start of the next school year. Sometimes companies have extra money in their budget they need to spend before the end of the year, so they'll buy more in December. Understanding your customers and their buying habits will help you identify the best launch window for your product. For feature releases for existing products, the launch timing depends on the launch type and goal. If it's a big update that will encourage new customers to buy your product, then you'll likely treat it like a new product and align the release with your customers' buying habits. Smaller releases' timing varies a lot. The only rule of thumb for these smaller releases is to release earlier in the week so that if any support issues arise, your team doesn't have to work over the weekend to resolve them. If the feature is a bug fix for a critical security issue, then your launch goal is to get this into as many customers' hands as possible as soon as possible. If it's a small update designed to improve the product for existing customers, your goal will also be to get as many existing customers as possible to update, but it's not as urgent. If your customer has to explicitly take an inconvenient action to upgrade, like restarting a computer, You'll want to schedule your releases to balance the value of the release with the inconvenience of upgrading. Fortunately, newer tools like the Mac App Store and the Windows Store are making upgrades easier for customers, automatically handling the inconvenient actions like restarting when customers are away from their computers. A common question is, what does launch mean, and how do you pick a date when you have an agile team producing usable products at the end of each sprint or cycle? It depends. For small features and bug fixes, often companies don't even bother with a launch plan and just deploy the feature when it's ready, just not on Friday. For larger releases, such as an important new feature, the company might choose to deploy the code internally but not release it publicly until a certain date. Scrum makes this easy because you'll pick a sprint whose date aligns with your launch window to be the release sprint. Velocity calculations and story point estimations will give you a good idea about what work will be available on that date. It's always smart to have the pre-release sprint be devoted to any last-minute, launch-related tasks that come up. And during the pre-launch phase, you can make sure that each sprint is on track towards release. During each launch team meeting, one discussion point will be, is everything still on track product-wise? If you find the velocity dropping, you might have to adjust your release plans. Once you've picked a possible launch date, you'll establish a workback schedule to determine what tasks you need to do when in preparation for launch. The week before launch, you'll do a press briefing. 2 weeks before, all video assets need to be ready, and so on. Testing. As part of getting ready to launch your product, it's important to put a plan together to test it with real customers so that you can make sure the product will deliver on its success metrics. Generally, companies first do an internal release of a product. The goal is to make sure everything works as expected and to catch major bugs before showing the product to any external customers. Next, companies do a broader beta, where they open up the product to a small group of external customers. This might be via an exclusive invitation to the top contributors on your support forum, or via some automatic opt-in. The former is a better approach for bigger releases, where you have specific new features you want customers to test. Creating a select group of customers to give early access is useful because it gives you a group of people who actively use your product, and they're the most likely to use the new features and to have valuable feedback. Early access also makes these customers feel special, and they'll often want to share that status with the world when your product is released. Specifically, this group often becomes product experts, providing tips and support to other customers and advocating for your product among their peers. Automatic opt-in is most common with web apps with a large number of users, where you can enable the feature for a short period of time for 1% of your customers and get valuable feedback. Automatic opt-in is fantastic because it gives you real data from real customers, likely exposing the product to far more customers than would manually opt in to the beta test. But it makes it hard to keep the new product a secret. Just look at how often people report seeing new Facebook features before there's an official announcement. Automatic opt-in might also generate complaints or a temporary drop in your success metrics, but that data will help you improve the product so it has a successful launch. Many companies have built internal tools to allow for selective feature rollout or testing, and Launch Darkly has built a general purpose tool that anyone can use. The key to planning a beta is thinking about how perfect your launch needs to be. If your product is a mobile app and new customers find it buggy, they're going to delete it and likely never reinstall it. Hardware is even less forgiving because a customer will return your product, and that costs you money to deal with. Web apps tend to be very forgiving, as you can update them multiple times an hour without the customer having to do anything. Of course, if you're strictly adhering to lean methodology, you'll do minimal, if any, testing and just keep releasing as fast as possible. But as we've mentioned before, most companies take a hybrid approach, which means you'll have some type of beta. you will either own or be heavily involved in product testing. A few key things that will help you run a successful beta test. Make sure your beta group matches your target personas. This will ensure that the people testing are the people you want to reach. Test your product messaging with any outreach you do. If you email certain customers to invite them to the beta, include the product messaging you think will make them want to use the product. It's also possible to A/B test messages to the same persona so that you can test which message gets the most people to sign up for the beta. Ensure you have appropriate onboarding. Onboarding is the first experience a customer has with your product or updated version. In the shipping product and later betas, it's usually where you call out key features and explain why they're useful and relevant. In a beta context, onboarding is extra important because it includes any specific testing instructions, such as what part of the product to specifically test or parts that you know don't work right yet. Sometimes an onboarding experience is as simple as a release notes email with instructions for installing the beta. Have feedback mechanisms in place. Make sure you have quantitative analytics tools in place to measure against your success metrics and to capture any crash logs. Provide a qualitative feedback mechanisms like Qualaroo or User Voice so the customers can tell you what they think and reach you with any issues. And follow up with customers to see what they think. Special beta forums can provide a great way for beta testers to interact, provide feedback, and help each other out. The key pieces of feedback to look for are the product's discoverability, engagement, repetition, people come back to use it, actual use cases, and any barriers to adoption. Assess your feedback and use it to inform launch decisions. Beta tests give you a chance to see if your product addresses customers' needs successfully and help you meet your success metrics with a small group. This gives you useful data about things you'll want to address before launch, like what bugs or other barriers to adoption many customers encountered. Sometimes you'll find a feature isn't discoverable and you need to add a call-out to it specifically or an onboarding experience to walk customers through using it. Sometimes you'll find something doesn't work as expected in the real world, and you'll decide to remove the feature. Occasionally, you'll find that the whole product just isn't good, and customers don't adopt it, and you'll cancel the launch. The most common result of a beta test is that you use the results to make a few minor changes and bug fixes, and then you do another beta test. After a couple of iterations with larger sample sizes in each, the product will be ready to launch. When putting together a GTM plan, establish when you want to run each testing phase, what you're aiming to get out of each phase, and who will own it. Generally, support or the PM will own the tests. Make sure to plan time to react to feedback from the betas before launch. For some products, you will also want to run stress tests with engineering during the pre-launch phase to make sure your technical capabilities can handle any demand. For example, some very popular products generate so much interest that their web servers crash because of the sudden spike in visitors. It's quite common to add a launch task for engineering to scale up your virtual server capacity during a launch window until traffic has leveled off to a predictable level. What kind of launch? Think about product launches you've seen before. Sometimes you just notice a new button appear in the UX with a pop-up tip telling you to check out something new. Other times, you don't get anything done for a couple hours because you're watching an Apple or Google presentation, large events we call Big Bang launches. It's important to align the type of launch you do with the product's scope and your capability. If you don't, your product might flop or even become the punchline to a joke. Back in 2011, a mobile app photo-sharing startup called Color focused on Big Bang announcements. It received $41 million in funding right off the bat, which was huge. Then, it launched its app with big fanfare, but there was a problem. Color focused on sharing with nearby users, But most people who downloaded Color found they were the only one using the app nearby and stopped using it. Color's poor testing pre-launch failed to discover this problem. Over the next few months, the company made changes to address these problems, but it had lost its momentum and the company shut down in 2012. Put simply, the product wasn't ready. The company did a big bang launch. People gave the product a shot and were disappointed, and Color never got a second chance. Alternatively, look at products like Gmail. Google tested it internally and then launched it with an invite-only beta. In addition to giving Google a chance to discover and fix problems before Gmail was huge, it created a feeling of exclusivity and demand for the product. Now, imagine that the new feature you're responsible for is adding a Watch Offline button to YouTube's mobile app. While this could be a great feature, you likely don't need a huge event to launch it. Instead, working with the press to get articles on various tech and media news sites and letting existing users know about the feature, either in-app or via direct communication, could be sufficient to achieve your launch goals, likely adoption in this case. Small events can be another great way to effectively launch and reach key influencers. For example, if Sonos were launching a new speaker lineup, it could do the following: rent a mansion, fill it with the Sonos speaker system, cater the event, invite key customers, partners, and members of the tech and audiophile press, and expect these influencers to write for outlets Sonos customers read. Sometimes, you'll work with a product that a customer really needs to experience to understand, especially if it's an expensive product. Would you buy a car just based on a review, or would you want to test drive it first? For these products, you'll need a launch strategy that is very hands-on focused, both for the initial launch and with follow-up events that let customers try the product. The VR/AR, virtual reality augmented reality space, is a great example. The best way for people to understand why VR/AR is compelling is for them to try it themselves. When HTC released its high-end Viva VR system, it had a traveling roadshow where customers could try the Viva in specially built trailers. These are the key things to think about for your launch type. Which personas care about this feature, and what customers do they map to? How will you reach new customers? How do you reach existing customers? What's your launch objective beyond reaching the right customers effectively? If you have a new product or a significant new version of an existing product, you'll want to reach new customers and existing customers, and a large event might be appropriate. If you have a new big feature, a small event or a series of press briefings focused on reaching existing customers and some new customers is likely more appropriate. If it's a small new feature, then reaching existing customers is more important than securing press coverage. For a small company struggling for attention, successful launches can be hard. You might do everything perfectly, but if customers don't show up, it doesn't matter. One simple approach is to build up an email list of interested customers pre-launch. A Tell Me More landing page for your product is a simple way to capture email addresses. This ensures that you're reaching people who are explicitly interested in your product. You'll want to make sure your outreach methods match your capability. If you have a salesperson who manually sends emails and makes calls, will he be able to handle the volume if you want him to reach out to thousands of customers the day your product launches? Many smaller companies choose to work with a PR agency that has connections at various media outlets to help get coverage in places your target personas look. That's another reason that knowing how your target customers find information, part of the business model canvas, is important. It lets you be efficient. Once you've picked how you want to launch, you'll align your launch planning on delivering what you need to make that method successful. Launch asset planning. No matter how small of a launch event you're planning, The launch team will always end up creating various assets to accompany the product launch. As the product manager, you'll often have a hand in creating these launch assets, even though other people will handle the details. Specific launch assets to consider include the following. Website updates. How will the product's page be updated on your website? Support documentation. What needs to be updated on your product's support page for the new version? Is there new training material to be created ahead of time? Sample video or images. Do you need to create new screenshots for the App Store or wherever you distribute the product? Blog posts and other social media material. What material do you want to create for the product's launch on your company's blog or social media channels? These outlets are called owned media because you control them, and you want to make sure they support your launch or company goals. Ads. Do you intend to have any advertising material with your product launch? If so, you'll need to create the media ahead of time. Demo plan. When company representatives are showing off the product, how will they demo the new product? Or, if you're releasing a new version or feature, how does it affect existing demo plans? Distribution review needs. Application stores like the App Store often require special reviewer logins or video demos so they can make sure your app works as designed. Do you have to create anything for this process? Internal product FAQ. If you're planning on doing press briefings as part of the launch, it's also handy to create an internal product FAQ with the questions you expect to get about the product from reporters. Having clear, on-message answers to common questions, including any hard questions you might get, helps whomever is doing the press briefings prepare effectively. Support team training materials. While the design, engineering, and product teams are likely quite familiar with the product when launch comes around, the support teams might not be as familiar. Create materials for them with the most common problems customers will face and the solutions. Use what you learned during your testing periods to gauge the most likely problems. During and after launch, update these training materials with any new questions that arise. Sales team training materials. As with support, it's important to create materials for the sales team so that the reps clearly understand the value in the product. These materials should focus on understanding the key buyer personas and what the product offers for them. For existing customers, be sure to provide migration information so that the sales team can help ensure smooth migrations. While not an explicit asset, make sure to work appropriately with any external partners so that they're not caught off guard by your launch. For example, with Mover, we'd want to make sure the moving companies have been notified and helped test our messaging feature. We might even choose to launch the updated web console with them quietly before launching the app to support a beta test. A helpful pre-launch marketing framework. There's a marketing framework that's very handy for the launch team to keep in mind as they determine how to launch a product. This framework, called the 4Ps framework, is a guide to making marketing decisions and a reminder of key decisions you have to make when launching a product. The Ps stand for product, price, promotion, and place. Let's dive into each. Product includes both the obvious parts of the product. What is it? Who's it for? What's the benefit? Along with the non-obvious. Non-obvious elements include the packaging, accessories, support, warranty, and return policy. A helpful way to remember these non-obvious elements is that they're things the customer encounters after purchasing the product. For example, after you buy it, you unbox it, or you buy an accessory, or you have a problem and contact support. Price refers to what you charge for, both normal everyday transactions and with possible volume and sale discounts. Determining the right price can be quite complex, and it's influenced by your product goals and your desired business model. Social games are often free to play to get as many people as possible downloading them, which enables a better social game. Then, ads help provide a small bit of income from each customer, and in-app purchases help generate revenue from engaged customers while also making the game better for them. Hardware pricing is commonly based on component pricing, but sometimes companies use a razor blade model and sell the core hardware at a loss, making money on software and accessories. As a product manager, you'll often have input on the pricing strategy, as the price is influenced by your product goals and has an impact on your success metrics and product planning. The next P is promotion. This is what we think of traditionally with marketing. What will your press release be like? What ads will you create? How will the sales team reach customers? Finally, we come to place. Where do your customers find your product for sale? Is it only on your website? Is it in specific stores, either virtual or physical? The key here is to make sure the place lines up with where your target customers go to find products. Some customers don't feel safe buying from a no-name startup's website, for example. They might be interested in your product, but they'll hold off buying it until it's available on Amazon. Or perhaps customers expect your app to be on the Google Play Store, and they'll look for it there instead of in the Amazon App Store. If you're not selling where your customers are, you'll miss out. Launch. The nice thing about planning thoroughly before launch is that during launch, you're mainly executing on your plan, which is relatively relaxing and even fun. Product managers are often company spokespeople, and we recommend working with your communication team to make sure you speak well and know the key product messages. And of course, if you're speaking externally, take care to look your best, wash your hands, trim your nails, and present a professional image. Back in the office, the engineering and support teams will want to watch to ensure everything is functioning correctly and customers are receiving any aid they need. You, as the PM, will also want to work with them to look for any critical bugs you might have missed during your testing phase. Have a plan in place with engineering ahead of time to assess, fix, and release these bugs as needed. But beyond that, you can take a breath and watch how your customers react to your hard work. We call the social media posts your customers write, reviews your product receives, and articles the press writes about your product earned media, because you don't control it, nor did you pay for it. Earned media is very valuable because it means people find your product worth writing about. Of course, the risk is that they don't like it and the earned media isn't positive. Fortunately, most people, especially professionals, usually choose not to write a review rather than writing something negative. Post-launch. In Chapter 9, we'll go into more detail for what you, the PM, will do post-launch. Most of your work will be internally focused, assessing early results and metrics and planning what's next. The marketing and sales teams will focus on how to promote and sell the new, current version. We'll briefly define some terms you might hear when working with those teams. The customer lifecycle. Just like we think about product funnels with analytics, covered back in Chapter 3, marketing also thinks about funnels. Sort of. Product marketing has become complex enough that many people think about engaging with customers as a loop called the customer lifecycle. Customers often start their journey with the awareness, interest, and engagement phases. This simply means people know about your product and seek to learn more. Marketing teams often pay for display and social ads to get more customers at this part of the funnel. A display ad is the typical visual advertisement we think of, such as an ad in a magazine or a banner ad. A social ad is an ad you pay for on a social network, whether it's a text ad on Twitter or an image on Instagram. What marketers love about online marketing is that it can be very targeted. Unlike a newspaper ad that lots of people see, online ads can be shown only to 31-year-old women who are interested in casual video games. This helps ensure your advertising reaches the right personas. The next life cycle phase is about getting people to trust your product will deliver on its promise and to buy it. Offering money-back guarantees is a common technique here. It often includes seeking out peer opinions and doing research on the product, such as looking for reviews. Affiliate marketing can help move customers through these steps. Affiliate marketing is when a trusted source receives a small payment for encouraging its audience to buy your product. Customers are happy because they now feel they can trust your product. Affiliates are happy because they received a payment for their expert advice, and your company's happy because you have a new customer. Sometimes companies provide special deals for their affiliate partners, such as discount codes, which gives new customers even more incentive to purchase your product. The last phases of the customer lifecycle are about customer satisfaction and advocacy. The ultimate goal of the customer lifecycle is to have customers advocating for you. Word of mouth is one of the most important factors in why people buy certain products, and it brings new customers into the customer lifecycle, making them aware of your product. While the support team will play the largest role in this phase, ensuring customers have a positive experience, the marketing team will often also help with customer retention and loyalty so that they in turn recommend the product again. They might do this by sending swag like t-shirts to customers, or by sending special offers to get the customer to make another transaction. If you've ever tried to cancel your cable, phone, or internet service, you've likely found yourself talking to a person whose job is to do whatever it takes to retain you as a customer, such as offering you a fantastic deal. As a customer moves through each phase, you'll need to make sure she sees the appropriate messaging and material. You don't need to show a money-back guarantee, which helps the trust phase, when you're trying to just make people aware of your product. The different messaging is important when working with search engine optimization and marketing, SEO, SEM. This is an entire field, and we're not going to go into it in depth, but SEO refers to how you optimize your site so that when people search for keywords, you're the relevant result. SEM is when you pay to have an ad for your website appear based on certain keywords. Marketing cost measurement terms. With all of these approaches, there are a few key terms you should be aware of, as they sometimes come up during strategy meetings between product and marketing. Pay per impression, PPI. You pay for the ad whenever it's shown. Impression means someone saw the ad. Pay per click, PPC. You pay for the ad only when someone clicks on it. Pay per action, PPA. You pay only when the user achieves some final action, such as downloading your app. Click-through rate, CTR, the percentage of people who click on your ad. Cost per impression, CPI, cost per thousand impressions, CPM. This is how much you pay to have your ad shown once, CPI, more commonly listed as the cost to have it shown 1,000 times, CPM. This can be used to assess how effective a campaign is. It's simply the advertising cost divided by the number of impressions. Cost per click, CPC. This is the actual price you pay for each click in your PPC advertising. In bid-based systems like on Google and Bing, this might be lower than the price you entered. For example, if you place the highest bid at $2 a click, which means you'd pay at most $2 for each click, the actual amount you'll pay is based on various factors, such as the closest competitor's bid and your ad quality. CPC is often used when there's a daily budget for running display and search ads. When you hit your budget, you stop running the ad for the day. As you'd expect, CPC is often CPI divided by CTR. Customer Lifetime Value, CLV or LTV. How much money do you expect to make from this customer over the product's lifetime? This is useful for determining how much to spend advertising to this customer. The CLV should be greater than what you spend to acquire the customer. If you have to spend $100 on display and affiliate promotions to acquire a customer but only expect to make $20 on this customer, you'll have lost money. Mover's GTM Plan. Here's a first pass at Mover's GTM Plan. The launch team will break these tasks down into explicit action items and assign them, and they might raise concerns during launch for issues not listed here, but this should give you an understanding of how to start thinking about launching and marketing a product. Key message: Mover takes the hassle out of planning a move. New feature message: Mover's new chat feature takes the hassle out of talking with movers. Pre-launch: how we will test this internally. We'll ask for volunteers on various teams to help test the mobile app and web dashboard for 10 minutes each day over the course of 2 weeks. By using both aspects, they can make sure everything goes through as they expected. Using the product for a few minutes each day is likely the most common use case. We'll also designate one person on the QA team to handle a different fake company in the database so that she can test the many clients one response source system. How will we test this externally? We'll ship it and turn it on for a small group of customers with no special announcement and see how usage changes, if customers have problems, and more. It's tough to create a beta pool for moving customers because people move and then don't do it again for a while. Letting customers try this feature also means we'll have to roll out the web portal to our moving companies earlier, as they'll need to be able to answer messages. We'll need to create training material for these companies and provide support. How will we launch this? This is not a huge feature, so it doesn't need much fanfare. However, because many people haven't heard of Mover, we want to use this to help generate fresh articles about our product. We'll work with our PR firm to do a small press tour, and we'll make sure the focus is on the core product message more than this specific new feature. We'll need to come up with a sample demo flow for these briefings. Perhaps we can have a fake moving company that automatically sends a series of replies on the back end so that it appears like you're having a real conversation with the company during the press briefing. What assets do we need to create? We need training and support materials for our moving company customers, updated screenshots and documentation for the website and app stores, and a blog post describing what's in this update. How will we reach customers? We don't have frequently recurring customers, so reaching existing customers isn't a big concern. We can continue to promote Mover in general on job boards like LinkedIn, given that after people get a new job, they often move. Launch. There should be very little to do during launch, aside from updating the website with new product information and releasing the updated app. We'll want to make sure our website can handle an increased visitor load, but given how infrequently people move, we don't expect a huge uptick in simultaneous active users in the app. Given we see an average of 1,000 users per day, we could start by assuming that each user sends 2 chats per day to every moving company he has a bid from. There's an average of 5 bids per user. This means we should be prepared to handle 1,000 times 2 times 5, or 10,000 chats per day, which isn't a huge number. We can adjust capacity as needed after things level off. Post-launch. We will continue to promote Mover as normal, especially focusing on targeted display and search ads. The general message is still the key message to promote, as our app awareness isn't at the point where it's worth advertising specific features initially. We'll want to watch how often people use the chat feature to make sure it's sufficiently discoverable and intuitive. For many in your company, especially the sales, marketing, and support teams, post-launch is when they really go to work. For you, this is the last major step in the product development lifecycle. Read on to learn how to finish up the lifecycle.
Thank you for listening to the Product Podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. For more product insights, head over to productschool.com.